Father, that our positions may be in line with your word, our thoughts may be in line with your thoughts. It's easy for us to go astray, Father, because our sin has affected our minds, our wills. Our minds can't understand truth, and our wills don't want to. So we ask that you touch our minds and enlighten them, and that you also touch our wills so that we may be made willing to believe these things. Teach us the truth, Father, in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, we're going through a history and theology of Calvinism, and tonight we're going to talk about what I call free Calvinism. Well, we've already said that John Calvin did not invent Calvinism. That's a rather myth-based charge that certain opponents of Calvinism make. They say, well, John Calvin invented these things. But tonight we're going to see that not only didn't he invent them himself, but he simply borrowed them and polished them from those that went before him. And later on in the series, we'll go and see exactly what the New Testament says. But tonight we're going to talk about what happened between the time of the New Testament and the time of John Calvin and Martin Luther. Calvin didn't invent Calvinism any more than Columbus invented America. They simply discovered what was already there. And so several people went before Calvin and made these same discoveries. And so I call them pre-Calvinists, and those of people that did it formulated pre-Calvinism. Simply put, someone could also say that Calvinism is purified Augustinianism, or Augustine was a pre-Calvinist. We're going to look at particularly at this fellow named Augustine. But let's step back one or two steps and see that the debate on Calvinism really goes back long before even the period of the New Testament. It's mentioned even in the Old Testament, these basic issues. Well, what are the basic issues that are discussed? Well, it's the old relationship of divine sovereignty and human responsibility. How do you balance them? How do you harmonize them? Are they at odds? And basically, people come down on one side or the other. They emphasize one more than the other, and it all gets back to our ideas of God. Well, it was debated in Greek philosophy and in Eastern religions. The post-Christian Jewish rabbis discussed this age-old problem, and some of them went more on one side, more on the other. We can see vestiges of it in the New Testament, for instance, in Paul. When Paul was debating the Galatian Judaizers, and they seemed to crop up in the letter to the Romans and Ephesians and elsewhere, they overemphasized human responsibility with the result that one is saved by his own responsibility, his faith and works, and that divine sovereignty and divine grace was minimized. And so Paul had to say it's by grace and faith, not faith and works. But this whole question of divine sovereignty and human responsibility underlay those theological issues. The question really boils down to this. Who initiates salvation and who responds? There are those that will say, well, it's basically man that initiates with faith and God responds with grace. And then the other side says, no, it's God initiates with grace and man simply responds with faith. And even the faith is a gift of God's grace. Well, as we'll see in tonight's lesson, those are the two basic answers, and that virtually all the people in the debate fall down in one or the other of the two categories, and some much further than the other. But also the question ultimately gets back to a correct doctrine of God. Even human responsibility is to be measured in terms of something in God, God's holiness, God's nearness, God's creation, and things like that. Let me draw just a very quick diagram that will illustrate some of what I'm saying. Let's put true Christianity right here in the middle, and of course we will argue later on that true Christianity or consistent Christianity is Calvinism. But then there are two extremes, either higher or lower. There are those that, and remember, all this gets back to God. True Calvinism and true Christianity says God is sovereign, man is responsible, but he's unable. Now, that's your basic paradox. But most other systems, getting back to the doctrine of God, overemphasize one or the other. And they all end up at two extremes. One of them way up here, yeah, that's up there, will be atheism, which in the end says God is nothing. There is no God. And the opposite extreme is pantheism. Now, you may wonder, what in the world has this got to do with Calvinism? Well, stick around, I'll show you. Pantheism, which says that God is everything. Just put God is all. Now, man also enters into this because how a person gives emphasis or de-emphasis to the responsibility, a man shows where he ends up on this system. Okay, atheism was an extreme of that, but then there's something just this side of that in ancient Greek philosophy called Epicureanism. Some of you all have used the term Epicurean delight, for instance. Epicureanism says, well, there's a God, but everything is basically chance. Even God is subject to chance. There is no order, there's no fate. It's just all blind chance, even though there is a God. So it's just short of atheism. Well, Epicurean's main rival was something extremely deterministic called Stoicism. Now, Stoicism was basically pantheistic, but it kind of shied back from the extremes of that. Stoicism said, well, there's this thing called fate, blind determinism, it's there. And then man's responsibility to that is simply in terms of apathy. Now, we're going to go into that a little bit in a little while. But these were the two main rivals, and actually both schools are mentioned in the New Testament. And then you get a little bit closer in here, back to the Epicureans here. Tonight, we're going to be looking at something called Pelagianism. Pelagianism will say, well, there is chance, God is real and personal, but yet the responsibility is primarily man's, not God. Man initiates, God responds. So we'll just put down here that man is the one that decides, not God. Okay, then we see another variety over here that gets a little bit closer to the truth, and yet it's still not Christian. And strangely enough, it is an old religion called Islam. Now, we're going to look at that also in a minute, how all of these are related to true Christianity. Islam basically says there's a God, of course, but it's not blind faith. But their idea of God is that basically God is cruel. Now, this is the one that overemphasizes divine sovereignty, and this is the one that minimizes divine sovereignty and really pushes man and chance and all that. Now, we're going to refer to that once or twice in our lesson tonight. The first question on the origins of Calvinism is this. Did Calvinism come from Stoicism, or did it come from Islam, or where did it come from? Now, you see, there are those that will say, okay, pre-Calvinism, where did it come from? What's the source of it? And there are those that will say Christianity or Calvinism is simply a baptized Stoicism. They say that's all that John Calvin did was simply borrowed from the Stoics. Now, their argument goes like this. They say, well, John Calvin, before his conversion, he was a student of philosophy and of law. But he particularly studied Stoic philosophy. His only book before he became a Christian was a commentary on Seneca's De Clementia. It was a commentary on that. And they say, well, Calvin just simply borrowed his Stoicism and he brought it into his Christianity with him. And so when we read Calvin, we're really reading a little Christianity, but a lot of Stoicism. They say that Calvinistic predestination is simply Stoic faith. Well, how do we respond to this? I want you to turn over to that passage in Acts 17. Acts 17, verse 18. By the time of the New Testament, Aristotle's philosophies and Plato's had kind of intermingled with other ones, and the two leading ones are found in Acts 17, verse 18. Paul there in Athens, and Luke records this instance. He says, also some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers were conversing with him. And some were saying, what would this idle babbler wish to say? Others, he seems to be a proclaimer of strange deities, because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. Well, these were the two leading Greek philosophies, and they were represented there at this Areopagus, this open-air debate. And Paul walks in the middle of them, and he catches flack from both extremes, just like true Christianity is going to catch it from both sides here. Well, the Stoics were a leading philosophy at the time. You've heard of Seneca, Zeno, Marcus Aurelius, and Epictetus. Now, those were the leading Stoics at the time. Well, Stoics stressed one thing in particular, faith. Blind faith, and that developed into natural law, providence, a cosmic determinism. Everything has already been determined for us. Well, where does that leave man? Where does he define his meaning in life? Well, they say faith in God, but in man it should be virtue. And what about virtue? Well, that's to be developed in submission to faith. Well, the opposite extreme was the Epicureans. The Epicureans said, no, it's not faith, but it's chance. There's nothing has been determined. Instead of everything, nothing has been determined. It's an indeterminism. And instead of virtue, well, what we should do is just simply give in to our natural impulses and give full sway to whatever our mind and our emotions tell us to do. The exact opposite of Stoicism. Stoicism would say that virtue is to be developed by this apathetic submission to blind faith. However, there are fundamental differences between Calvinism and Christianity on the one hand and Stoicism. So it is not correct to say that Calvinism is simply a Christian form of Stoicism. Stoicism was basically pantheistic. God is everything, and everything is God, and that's the way that this system developed. Also, the Stoic God was basically impersonal and impassible. Impassible means that God has no emotions, which means he has no joy, he has no anger, which means also the Stoic God says God has no love, and God has no wrath against sin. He's an emotionless God. He is impassible, and also he is impersonal. Now, the Stoics did stress that God had determined all things. All things are already pre-written. It's already preordained for us. But remember, that's to be seen in the light of the fact that their God is basically everything. And so, Stoic fate is not the same thing as Christian predestination or Christian providence. Now, the early Stoics said that even God is under fate, but in time they came to equate God and fate and providence and natural law. They came to be seen as basically the same thing, an impersonal God that is everything. Now, that obviously eliminated the possibility of miracle. That's why Acts 17 is so crucial. It says here that they were denying what Paul was preaching about the resurrection. The resurrection is a great miracle. The Stoics didn't believe in miracles because miracle is something supernatural coming into the natural realm. But to them, everything was natural. God is everything. God is basically natural law. They also denied special revelation, such as Scripture. God is all, therefore even matter, in some respect, is eternal, and God is in charge of everything. Now, this also distorted human responsibility. Because God was so sovereign and it was overemphasized, human responsibility was simply seeking out virtue by this apathetic giving in to the inevitable. They had a word for it, apatheia, from which we get the English word apathy. Now, we've heard about Stoic people who say, he's just an old Stoic, which means he's apathetic, he's emotionless. Well, that gets back to the Stoic idea of apatheia, which is an extreme passivity of emotions and will. The opposite of the Epicureans that said give in to it, the Stoics said just simply submit to the inevitable. That was apatheia, and you were to suppress your emotions and your will. Obviously, there is no place for original sin in their system. Man may become perfect by this apatheia, but he may also lose his perfection. And of course, the Stoics said there's no life after death. So you see, there are fundamental differences between Stoicism and Christianity. And yet there is a semblance of similarity. They did stress that things have been determined in advance, that things aren't just going about helter-skelter by chance. How do we explain this vestiges of similarity between what the Bible says about the sovereignty of God and Stoicism? And the answer to that will answer the question that says, did Calvinism come from Stoicism? Well, did the Christians borrow from the Stoics? No. One or two Calvinists have suggested that the early Stoics, particularly Zeno, the father of Stoicism, they were actually Jews that had wandered away from Israel and started this school over in Athens. Well, that's conceivable, but it's a little hard to prove. It'd be more precise to explain it like this. Ephesians 2:13 says that Gentiles at one time were without God and were afar off. However, some of them were further off than others, which means that some of them were closer to the truth than others. If you look at your different Greek philosophies, you'll see some of them are way far off, like the Epicureans, and other ones were a little bit closer. They weren't as far off. And on this point of determinism, the Stoics just simply happened to be closer than the other Greek philosophies. They were closer to the truth than others. Now, this isn't to suggest that the Stoics were sort of a pre-Christian Christian. Thomas Aquinas would virtually make Aristotle a pre-Christian Christian. And we're not suggesting that. We're simply saying that Stoicism was closer to true Christianity than most of your Greek philosophies, particularly on the point of determinism of what's going to happen. And yet there are fundamental differences. Well, also, the debates between the Stoics and the Epicureans were similar to the debates between Augustine and Pelagius, Calvin and Arminius, and others. But the Bible never borrowed from Stoicism. Paul had differences with both the Stoics and the Epicureans. And so we did not borrow from them. It's more likely that our opponents borrowed from the Epicureans. Let me boil that down. Later on, we're going to go into the Arminians and the Pelagians. It's more likely that they borrowed from this chance idea of the Epicureans than that we have borrowed from the Stoics. They have more similarities with them than we have with the Stoics. Okay? So Christianity and Calvinism didn't come from Stoicism. Well, then another charge comes up, okay? You didn't get it from the Stoics, you got it from the Muslims. Calvinism is simply Christian Islam. I don't know if you've ever heard that. They say that Calvinistic predestination is just like the Islamic idea, 'tis the will of Allah. And And they say we are simply to submit to this blind, not faith, but this overarching philosophy of the Islam, of Islamic religion. Well, Dr. Samuel Zwemer, who's often called the apostle to the Mohammedan world, said, Islam is indeed in many respects the Calvinism of the Orient. I wonder how many of y'all know what the name Islam means. It means submission. Submission to what? Submission to this overarching sovereignty of Allah. And so you are to say, 'Tis the will of Allah. That is actually the Islamic kind of faith. And that kind of submission is very similar to the Stoic apatheia, giving into the inevitable. The Stoic, Islamic idea is, well, it's the will of Allah. We can't stop it. We can't forbid it. We can't go along. We just simply submit to it. That's the way it is. But that's not the Christian idea. You may know the story about the Christian and the Muslim that were on a ship, and a man fell overboard. And here's a Christian and a Muslim looking at the man falling in. And the Muslim said, 'Tis the will of Allah. If I were to go in to save, if he was predestined to be saved, then he'll be saved whether I jump in or not. And of course, I don't want to thwart the will of Allah. 'Tis the will of Allah that the man fell in and drowned.' And the Christian said, 'Tis the will of God that I jump in and save the man.' And he was saved. God uses second causes, whereas Islam and Stoicism basically said, no, it's the will of Allah. We shouldn't interfere in it. And yet there is an apparent similarity on this strong doctrine of divine sovereignty. How do we explain the similarity? In the same way we explain Stoicism. You look around all the different religions of the East. Some of them are very far off, and other ones are closer to the truth. Islam is actually much closer to the truth than Hinduism is. Hinduism says there are 390 million gods. Islam says one God. So on that point, they are closer to the truth. And yet, they're still very far off. Those that would say that the Calvinists have simply borrowed the Islamic idea of the sovereignty of God don't know their church history. Not only was the New Testament written 500 years before the Quran, but Augustine lived about 200 years before Muhammad. And so our doctrines are almost verbatim taken from Augustine and the New Testament. Calvin and the Calvinists never quoted the Quran. They appealed to Scripture. One other fundamental difference. Islam is basically a religion of good works, not of grace. Now, in the Quran, they often say Allah is the Almighty, the Merciful. But even their concept of Allah is not one of a loving God, but of one that is a cruel God. In history, we've seen that Islam is basically a religion of cruelty and force. It knows no such thing as mercy. They don't operate many hospitals. Their idea of mercy is something foreign to their religion, and yet they will call Allah the Merciful. The Allah of Islam is not the same as the true God of the Bible. The Muslim Allah is more the author of evil, because Islam tends to blur the differences between good and evil. In fact, the Islamic Allah has more in common with the Christian Satan than the Christian God. Allah is not the same as Elohim. Allah is a false God. He is a cruel God. And I'm sure I'll be in competition with Salman Rushdie for saying these things, and maybe I'll have a bounty put on my head like Mr. Rushdie. Personally, I consider that a high honor if certain fanatical Ayatollahs were to come gunning for me for what I've just said. Okay, so it didn't come from Islam and it didn't come from Stoicism. Where did it come from? Well, we allege that it comes from the Bible, and we can prove that. But we also see that there were certain early Christians that did discover these doctrines known as the doctrines of grace. And we can see them peppered throughout church history between the time of the New Testament and the time of Luther and Calvin. And we're going to look at two or three of them this evening. Well, some say, what about the apostolic fathers? What about the early church fathers? Well, they didn't discuss this paradox of sovereignty and responsibility too much. They were generally out debating things like Gnosticism, monasticism. They said more about Gnosticism than they did about Stoicism. But then as history developed, various heresies began to enter the ranks of the churches, such as baptismal regeneration, that baptism produces the new birth. That was a heresy that came in. Sacramentalism, monasticism. You that remember our study on Catholicism, we discussed monasticism. Monastic idea was that you withdraw from the world and you only eat certain things, bread and water, and you punish your body and you become a hermit, and that's the way of attaining salvation. Papalism developed in the first few centuries as well. Now, those heresies provide very fertile soil for the major heresy that we're going to talk about tonight, called Pelagianism. This idea of man doing certain things by monastic vows and asceticism and sacraments, that gave rise to Pelagianism. Who was Pelagian? Pelagius was a British monk, and he was an ascetic. That is, he was almost a hermit. He said that he can attain perfection and salvation by doing without certain things and by exerting a strong will in the direction of God. That will, in fact, bring a certain kind of salvation. And he overreacted against those that simply gave in to sin because they said, well, I'm a sinner, I can't help but sin. He came from Britain and he traveled around the Mediterranean world, Rome, North Africa, and Palestine. He gained a number of followers, some more extreme and some more moderate, but he was more or less the leader of them. Now, some years later, his heresy, known as Pelagianism, was condemned, but he basically got off scot-free. His heresy was condemned, but not him. Pelagius was an ascetic. He strove for salvation like this, and this was part of this monastic way of salvation. It was legalistic to the core, but it was overreacting against a form of antinomianism. Now, Pelagius said more about man than he did about God. He didn't go into the details of divine sovereignty or limited sovereignty, but you can glean that from what he does say about man. What Pelagius mainly spoke about was man is able to exert his will in the direction of God. And he gets back to, really, his views of Adam. Pelagius thought that Adam was created morally neutral, neither good nor evil, but with a neutral will. And that when he sinned, that didn't really affect his will. It only changed his destiny. Consequently, Adam sinned only for himself. He did not pass on sin because the sin didn't really affect him himself, only his destiny. It didn't touch his will, didn't really touch his mind or his emotions. And so there was nothing to pass on to others. Pelagius denied all forms of original sin. He says that when we are born in the world, we are born in the same state as in which Adam was created. Adam was created neither good nor evil, but morally neutral. When we come into the world, we come into the same way that Adam and Eve did as well. No sin, no goodness, we are a blank tablet, and it's up to us now to determine what to write on it. But then the question comes up, Mr. Pelagius, why do people sin? Why has everybody sinned since the time of Adam? He says, well, it's because we have bad examples. Everyone around us are sinners, and we grow up with a blank tablet, and obviously we look around us, and we borrow from other people. That's where sin comes from. Not that we were born with it, we just simply copy other people. But we're not born with sin, we're not born with the propensity to sin, and we're certainly not born with the guilt of Adam's sin. They say Christ alone was born without sin, in that sense. However, the question that some of Pelagius' opponents put to him was this. If we sin only by following examples, why didn't Christ sin? He had the same examples of Peter, Paul, James, John, the rest of them in his day. Why didn't he sin? And Pelagius couldn't give an adequate answer. Now, here's where Pelagius also waffled. In some respects, he said Christ was the only one that never sinned. But on the other hand, he said, well, wait a second. He's the only one at that time that never sinned, and nobody since the time of Christ has been without sin. We've all given in to the bad examples. But he said there were some people before the time of Christ that never sinned, and he gave a few examples from the Old Testament. That's how they attained to salvation. Infants today, well, infants have never been born with sin. They learn it by example. And so when that child grows up, he begins to imitate other people, and some go longer before they imitate sin. And some it's just a short time, and some a long time, but they're not born with it. They pick it up like a disease from other people. And even when they do sin, that doesn't affect their free will. Their will is never really in danger. It's only their destiny. Pelagius said this, quote, all men, therefore, have a free will to sin and not to sin. It is not free will if it requires the aid of God, because everyone has within him the power of his own will to do anything or not to do it. Our victory over sin and Satan proceeds not from the help which God affords, but is owing to our own free will. Whether we will or whether we will not, we have the capacity of not sinning. One of his favorite maxims was this, if I ought, I can. If I ought to do something, I am able to do something. I am responsible, therefore I am able. Well, where does grace come into his system? He didn't deny grace, but he said grace comes to make things more easy for you, but you could do it yourself anyway. Grace simply comes to grease the wheels, to make it easier for you to do. What about Christ's atonement? Well, he basically said Christ's atonement was the best example for us to follow. So instead of following the bad examples all around us, Christ lived a good life and died a good death for us as that perfect example. And by meditating on that, we can wipe away what's on the slate that's been already marred by following bad examples. What about predestination? Well, that can be deduced from what he says that, well, man exerts his will in the direction of God. That is basically salvation. God foresees that, and he says, I'll choose that person that exerts his will in that direction and in that way. Election is simply God foreseeing that man would choose God. And of course, grace is universal, it's resistible, and of course, because man's will is not affected either by grace or by sin, man can still decide not to follow that good course, he can lose his salvation. Now that in a nutshell is Pelagianism, basically saying man is not that bad. Well, what do the rest of the church feel? Some wondered if these things are so, but then God raised up a man in North Africa to counter this mad British monk. The man from North Africa was Aurelius Augustinus, or as we know him as, Augustine. Some of you may want to call him Augustine, and I won't quibble with it. Who was Augustine? Well, he had a Christian mother and a non-Christian father, and so he had divided loyalties, and when he grew up, he decided to get away from the Christian mother that was praying for him, and he spent his youth in dissolute licentiousness. And then he joined the Manichaean cult. And he wandered around the Mediterranean world and picked up a mistress, and he lived in drunkenness, in very external, gross sin. And then, for some reason or other, he got very interested in a certain preacher in Milan, Italy, named Ambrose. And he first, what attracted him was simply his great eloquence, but then he began to think, maybe he's got the answers after all. And so as he heard Ambrose, he came under conviction of sin, and he was dramatically and suddenly converted. But Augustine never forgot how sinful he was and how gross his sin became. He learned the lesson that sin is a wild animal, and that seething within his being was this cauldron of sin that he could not control. Now that was the exact opposite of Pelagius. Pelagius had never really gotten into this gross external sin. For him, it was just basically something internal and having to do with your destiny. But Augustine had learned that sin is not to be trifled with. Augustine was the most important of the early church fathers, also the most prolific writer. The Confessions, the City of God, the Trinity, his Retractationes, his Retractations, as we would call them, many commentaries, wrote more than anyone else, especially against Pelagius. He thought Pelagius was bringing in a gross heresy over which there can be no compromise. Pelagius' heresies was threatening the very essence of the gospel. Now, point by point, Augustine countered Pelagius. And his oppositions will sound very familiar to us that have studied Calvinism. First off, the subject of original sin. Augustine staunchly defended the biblical doctrine of original sin. He says, all men have inherited sin from Adam and from our parents, except Christ. We have inherited the sin, the necessity to sin, in other words, we always will sin, and we even inherit the guilt of Adam's sin. How do you explain it? Well, his favorite verse is back in Romans 5:12. He says that we were in Adam physically, and our souls are taken from Adam. Therefore, when Adam sinned, we were in Adam sinning. And so that is the origin of our souls. In theology, we call this traducianism. And so Adam had a totally free will before the fall, but when Adam sinned and we sinned in Adam, that will was killed. It now can only sin, and we are born with that in us. We inherit the same thing as Adam's fallen state. Adam's sin is passed on down through what's called the concupiscence of sexual relationships. But Christ was born of a virgin. He never received original sin because his mother never had sexual relations with a man. Therefore, Christ never inherited original sin. But all of the men inherit this fallen state. They are born spiritually dead. They are not born in the state that Adam was created in. Secondly, Augustine said, because we inherit this, we necessarily follow through with it. We inherit original sin, but we always practice actual sin. In other words, it's not simply what we did in Adam, it's what we do in ourselves as well after we are born. We practice actual sin, and we can do no other. Man is spiritually and morally dead, both in his mind and in his will. Now here's where Augustine really waxed very eloquent and scriptural. He says the will of man is dead. Pelagius said the will of man is neutral. It can do good, it can do bad, and even when it does bad, it's not dead, it's still free. Augustine plunged his knife into that and said, no, it is dead. It is dead and it is rotting. Man cannot do good externally he can do it, but even when he does external good, he does it for bad motives. He cannot do a single good thing in his will, and that is where the root of sin or goodness is. Man is dead. What's more, man can never merit any good whatsoever from God. Even when God later assists the will and gives it life, that is not merit. Merit is only to be found in God. Again, he differed with Pelagius, who basically said when man exerts his will positively, he merits something from God. Also, man can only sin. He cannot do good. He cannot exert his will in the direction of God. Various illustrations have been used of this. He can sin more, but he cannot sin less. He cannot stop from sinning. He cannot reverse himself. He cannot do good, and he cannot make up for the sins of a lifetime. Now, there have been two very good illustrations of this. One of them, an old one, that says, man is riding on a wild horse, and he doesn't hold the reins. The horse is out of control. He doesn't hold the reins. He holds the whip in his hand. He can only make the horse go faster. He cannot make it go slower, and he cannot turn the horse around. That's the old illustration. Or to use a modern analogy, man is sitting at the wheel of a car. The car is going out of control, but the car has no brakes. And man's foot is tied to the accelerator. It can go faster, but he cannot go slower, and he cannot turn himself around. He is hopelessly dead in his will. Augustine further taught that even when man attempts to will anything, he only makes things worse. And yet, for all of this hopelessness, man is still responsible. His inability to obey does not negate his responsibility before God. In fact, it only compounds it. Wherein does the salvation come? Well, Augustine did teach that Christ died a substitutionary atonement, but the scholars are a little bit divided over whether Augustine taught a limited and particular atonement or whether it was a universal atonement. But he said he was more than just simply a good example for us. So far as how grace is given to us, he tended to say that it's by infusion rather than imputation. Now, y'all that have listened to Dr. Johnson over the years know just what that means. He will say that we receive Adam's sin by it being infused into us, that after all, we were in him. And it says the same thing with Christ's righteousness. It's not simply imputed to us, but it's infused into us. That's how we are saved. Grace is infused into us in justification. Now, here's where we see another one of Augustine's weakest areas. His, in his doctrine of the church. Augustine was still a man of his age, and he still went in for the sacramental system. He still saw that baptism was essential for salvation, and it's through the waters of baptism that saving grace is infused into our souls. Consequently, he said, no baptism, no salvation. He would say, what about infants that die without baptism? He says they die in their original sin, and they go to hell. He says that's the logical conclusion of his doctrine. Pagans that never hear the gospel also go to hell because they've never heard the gospel and they've never received baptism. And also Augustine said salvation is through the true church. In his mind, that basically meant the Roman Catholic Church, which is in agreement with the Bishop of Rome. Now, this was particularly the early Augustine that stressed salvation through the church. But if you look at the history of Augustine, you see that slowly he was getting away from that and saying more and more it was divine grace and God's sovereignty. It's been speculated that if Augustine had lived another 10 or 20 years, he would have taught justification by imputation, not by infusion, and he would have said it's not even by baptism, but it's solely by God's grace. Benjamin Warfield observed that the Reformation was really a debate between the early Augustine and the later Augustine. The early Augustine that stressed the church would correspond to the Roman Catholic Church, and the later Augustine that stressed the sovereignty of God's grace, that would be comparable to what Luther and Calvin taught. But what did Augustine teach about election and predestination? Well, here's where he elaborated on this. He says, God chose only some people to be saved through grace. Grace is sovereignly given, but God chooses to whom he gives it, and there are different kinds of grace. Election is not based upon, as Pelagius thought, God looking down the annals of history and says, there's a man that's going to choose me, therefore I'm going to choose him. Augustine taught the exact opposite. He said, a man is saved because God chooses him, not because he chose God or even that God foresaw that he would choose God. Man is unable to choose God. Therefore, he only chooses God because God makes him or enables him to choose him. And so that is his doctrine of election. What's his doctrine of grace? Against Pelagius, Augustine says grace is always totally undeserved and is always freely given, not in response to man asking for it, because man can't ask for it. To ask for grace would be a good thing. It'd be in the direction of God. But man never exerts his will in the direction of God, even to ask for grace. Therefore, God has to freely give it and turn man's will around. Now, the early Augustine taught that man does his part in asking for it, and God does his part in giving it. But later on, Augustine retracted that. He says, no, man is unable to do his part. Man cannot do his part. God has to do it for him. And so his favorite maxim was, give what thou commandest, O Lord, and command what thou wilt. That really irritated Pelagius. He said, that's giving too much to God and not enough to man. But Augustine said, that is the essence of what grace is. God gives what he commands. He demands us to obey him. We can't obey him, so God gives that which he demands. That was his doctrine of grace. Well, he also elaborated the different kinds of grace, some grace before conversion, some kinds afterwards, restraining grace. But he said grace is always freely given and not in response to man asking for it. Consequently, man will persevere. Man's will is upheld by God's grace. Therefore, God is pledged to keep giving grace. Man will persevere to the end. Justification is irreversible. The elect will make it to heaven, and not a single one of the elect will be lost. He says perfection in this life is impossible. But man still has that old nature around with him. He still has vestiges of original sin and actual sin that tend to bring him down, but God brings him back up. Predestination, Augustine said God is absolutely sovereign, and predestination of all things is unconditional. God has predestined everything. Now, Augustine was a little slow to apply this to the doctrine of the origin of sin. Now, he did make some comments on it, but he did not go as far as others. This was a new area for him. Augustine basically said that sin doesn't have an existence. It's like a shadow. It's something that doesn't have an existence of itself. Now, I want you to follow me on this. It's very Augustinian. In more modern theology, we would say that evil is not a Ding an sich. That's German for it doesn't have a thing in itself. Evil is not a thing, it's the absence of good. God positively predestined good because it has an existence. God is good. But God did not positively predestine evil. It is a byproduct. It is an emptiness. It is a shadow, as it were. It doesn't have something of itself. But yet God is still ultimately responsible because he is sovereign and he has predestined it to come into being. But he didn't explore that too much. And the same thing with the opposite of election. He didn't explore too much the details of non-election. The idea of reprobation is more implicit than explicit in Augustine. Well, Pelagius put all the emphasis on man. Augustine put the emphasis on God's grace. Pelagius said man is able. Augustine said man is dead, but he's still guilty, and he's still responsible. Well, those were your two major opponents. What about their successors? Well, Pelagius had a successor named John Cassian. And Cassian came along, and he was over in France, and his followers were French. And they said, well, Pelagius went a little bit too far. And Augustine went too far. Let's try to get in the middle here. They said, well, this is what's called semi-Pelagianism. They said, well, man does inherit something from Adam, but not the guilt, nor the necessity of the guilt, but a certain tendency to sin. It's not a perfectly blank tablet, but there's a certain tendency to sin. Now, that's different than Pelagius. It said man has no tendency to do good or evil. The semi-Pelagian said man is born without the guilt of Adam, but he still is born with that tendency to sin. They modified it like this. The semi-Pelagians would say man's will is not dead, nor is it perfectly healthy. It's sick and it's dying. Man is half good, half evil. He can't save himself, but he can still ask for God's grace. He's still able in that respect to say, God, give me grace. He can't exert his will totally to heaven, like Pelagius tended to imply, but he can at least ask for a boost up from God, and that boost up is God's grace. So they say that man asks, God gives, and that's how salvation is accomplished. Man initiates, God responds. Now, they said that this is somewhere between Pelagius and Augustine. It's in the middle. But if you look closely at it, you see that it's really another form of Pelagianism. It's much closer to Pelagianism than to Augustinianism. Get back to that idea of the will. Pelagius said the will of man is still alive. Semi-Pelagius said, well, it's alive, but it's sick. Augustine said it's dead. And there's a whole lot of difference between something being sick and being dead. A sick person has more in common with a well person than he does with a dead person. Semi-Pelagianism is really just a revamped Pelagianism. It still gets back to the heresy that man initiates and God responds. Also, they say that semi-Pelagians, like the Pelagians, said that man does not inherit the guilt of original sin or the necessity to keep on sinning. And so God raised up an Augustinian named Prosper of Aquitaine. He was the leader of the Augustinians. He said Augustine was right, Pelagius was wrong, and John Cassian is wrong. So God raised this man up to do battle, and he prospered in it. Well, in some respects, he modified Augustine, but in other ways, he elaborated and went a little bit further. Well, just as Pelagianism was condemned, so was semi-Pelagianism. But we see something very interesting happen in church history at this point. There were certain loopholes in the condemnation, as if to say, well, semi-Pelagianism is wrong, but it's not that wrong. And we will see how they took advantage of these loopholes. Many of the men that followed claimed to be Augustinian, or even semi-Augustinian, but in fact, they were really semi-Pelagians in disguise. Well, we go a few hundred years after the times of Augustine and John Cassian and Prosper, and we come up to another man in Germany this time, named Gottschalk. He lived in the 9th century. He was a German monk. He was a poet. And he traveled around Europe, preaching in German, writing in Latin, but got himself in trouble. He had followers, he had opponents, and the opponents said, we don't like what he's preaching. Well, what they didn't like was his doctrine of predestination. Now, his teaching was really Augustinianism, point by point by point. He simply elaborated on what Augustine had already said. Let me give you the following summary from his own pen. Gottschalk wrote as following. Before all worlds and before whatever God did from the beginning, he foreordained to the kingdom whom he willed, and he foreordained to death whom he willed. Those that have been foreordained to death cannot be saved. Those who have been foreordained to the kingdom cannot perish. God does not wish all men to be saved, but only those that are saved. What the apostle says, who desires all men to be saved, is said of all those who are saved. Christ did not come that all might be saved, nor did he suffer for all, but only for those who are saved by the mystery of his passion. And after the first man fell by free will, no one can employ free will for doing good, but only for doing evil. That's really just a polished form of Augustinianism, point by point. And actually, this is a form, a very polished form of pre-Calvinism. Next time someone asks you if you're a Calvinist, say, I'm a Gottschalkian. And I'm sure you'll confuse them. Gottschalk. Well, let's look point by point at what he taught and polished in Augustine. He taught the same doctrine of original sin. Man inherits original sin, the guilt, and the necessity of sinning. His will is death. That's more or less what Augustine taught. On salvation, well, unfortunately, Gottschalk still taught that baptism was essential, but he modified that. His opponents kept saying, what Gottschalk is saying is that baptism is really not that essential. Grace is given freely, not necessarily through the waters of baptism. But Gottschalk felt that he shouldn't elaborate that too much. He went to the other areas of elaboration. He did agree with Augustine that dying unbaptized infants do go to hell. And he also agreed that all true believers will persevere to the end. But like Augustine, he believed in infused righteousness rather than imputed righteousness. But unlike Augustine, who seemed to be a little bit unclear about who did Christ die for, Gottschalk was very explicit. Christ died only for the elect and not for the non-elect. It's very explicit in Gottschalk. Gottschalk also polished up Augustine's doctrine of predestination. What was implicit in Augustine was explicit in Gottschalk. Like Augustine, he taught that God ordained everything that happened, and that's based upon sovereignty, not foresight. Now, here's one of the areas that he really polished, getting back to the nature of God. He says that God foreordains everything because of his own will, his own foreordination of everything, not his foresight. He said, yes, God does know all things, but it's his foreordination that logically precedes his foreknowledge of all things. They're both eternal. But in the logical order, God cannot know something unless God has ordained it to happen for sure. And that's an extremely fine point. And once you grasp that dilemma, you will see exactly where all of these problems come from. Those that say God foreordained something because he foresees it's going to happen, that leads to Arminianism, Pelagianism, and all the rest of it. But Gottschalk saw the really fine point there, that God foreordains it, and on the basis of that, he foresees that it's going to happen. Therefore, election is particular. It's not based on this foreseen faith that's going to be there. It is based upon his sovereign will. Moreover, Gottschalk said that one can know that he's one of the elect. He even implied a person can know if he's one of the reprobate, which, of course, Augustine never said. He never elaborated in that direction. But here's where Gottschalk really got into trouble. double predestination. You say, well, wait a second, Kurt, I'm having enough trouble with predestination. What is double predestination? Well, Gottschalk elaborated this. What was implicit in Augustine, Gottschalk made very explicit. What's double predestination? Double predestination is like negative election. If God chose some, then obviously he rejected others. That's the doubleness of predestination. This is what Gottschalk taught. He said, if God willed for everybody to be saved but still rejected some, then there'd be a contradiction in God. All people are not saved. It's because God did not ultimately will for all people to be saved. God does not change his mind. God does not change his will. Now, Gottschalk was probably the first one to use this phrase, double predestination. Quote, predestination, whether the elect to life or the reprobate to death, is twin. There is therefore a twofold predestination of the elect to blessedness and of the reprobate to death. Well, one scholar has commented, to Gottschalk, God is just in all his ways, though those ways are past finding out. One of Gottschalk's opponents, Hincmar, also agreed that God is just in all his ways, but he said that God's ways must conform to our ideas of justice. And there's a fundamental difference between the two of them. Another scholar commented, the doctrine of Gottschalk stands forth, rugged and strong. It is built upon this one thought, God is supreme, and man in comparison is nothing. Well, what happened to Gottschalk? Got him into a lot of trouble. He taught that this extreme view, this strong view of predestination and the sovereignty of God, and that rubbed on the nerves of his opponents. He accused his opponents rightly of semi-Pelagianism, but they outnumbered him. And they got together several synods, and they put him on trial. He refused staunchly to recant, but he was convicted because he was outnumbered. Well, his punishment was in three forms. First, he was ordered to gather up all of his writings and throw them into a fire, even though he knew and could prove that what he taught was simply what Augustine had taught 400 years ago. And even if his opponents would say Augustine was the greatest of the church fathers. But he knew that they weren't following him and they were not following the scriptures. So they forced him to throw his writings into a fire. Secondly, Gottschalk was severely flogged with a whip. In fact, there was an outcry all around there saying, you almost killed a man by doing this. That's torture. So they did torture him. And there was an outcry. But the third and the worst was that he was condemned to spend the rest of his life locked up in the dungeon of a Roman Catholic monastery on a poor diet. And you say, was that just for a couple of years? No, he spent 20 years imprisonment in this dungeon for only teaching what Augustine had taught, and he could prove it. But by proving that, he only exposed the hypocrisy of the semi-Pelagian persecutor. Toward the end of his life, he apparently had a nervous breakdown in prison, and he died soon after. But he never recanted, because he always said, God is sovereign in all this, and God's going to carry me through to the end. Those of us that love the doctrines of grace taught by Scripture, also taught by Augustine, have been angered by the hypocritical judgment on Gottschalk. His accusers, they claimed to be following Augustine, but they were blatantly semi-Pelagian. The descendants of those that persecuted Gottschalk, such as in the Roman Catholic Church, owe an apology to this great man of God. And they owe an apology to all those that have followed in the footsteps of Augustine and Gottschalk. He suffered the consequences, and that set the tone for centuries to come. Now, what I've said about Gottschalk explains one big mystery. You say, where did the Catholic Church go wrong between Augustine and Thomas Aquinas? It was when they condemned Gottschalk. Because then they said, well, we're still following Augustine, but they were really following the semi-Pelagians and ultimately Pelagius. Well, during the Middle Ages, some of your scholars were a little bit closer to Pelagius, some of them less close, some of them more semi-Pelagians. Some of them did try to get back to Augustine and through Augustine to the Scriptures. Some of them got closer than others. Anselm, Bernard, Duns Scotus, some of the other ones. And then John Wycliffe and John Huss came along, and they were almost purely Augustinian, just like Gottschalk. But they didn't get off as lightly as Gottschalk did. They were burned at the stake. It was left to another man to come along to get back to the Scriptures and to rediscover the doctrines of Augustine. This man came along again out of Germany like Gottschalk, and he would be studying Augustine because he was an Augustinian monk. And by studying Augustine, he was driven back to the Scriptures, and he rediscovered just what Augustine had discovered, and this would cause even more trouble than Wycliffe and Huss and even Gottschalk. He caused a revolution, and the revolution is called the Reformation, and that monk's name is Martin Luther. Next week we'll look at the damage Martin Luther did and the great revolution of grace that he ushered in.